Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. James Baldwin would have turned 90 this year. You may have read The Fire Next Time or Go Tell It to the Mountain or Notes of a Native Son. He was an essayist, poet, novelist, and as you can hear, a social critic.
First of all, I'm speaking as an American citizen. I'm speaking as also as a grandson of a slave.
My mother was born in Maryland. My father was born in New Orleans. I was born in New York.
Someone who represents a very complex country which insists on being simple-minded.
As a black and gay writer who was prolific in the mid-20th century, Baldwin's work persists, and a year-long celebration launches next week to recognize his contributions and his activism. This year's festival from New York Live Arts is called James Baldwin This Time. Joining us now is the festival's curator, Lawrence Weschler, who wears many hats, among them nonfiction writer. Hello, Ren.
Hi, great to be here again.
The writer Jamaica Kincaid, who is participating in the opening keynote conversation, also joins us. Her most recent work is See Now Then. Jamaica Kincaid, thank you very much for joining us. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you.
And with us is Rich Blint, who is a Baldwin scholar and associate director of the Office of Community Outreach and Education for the School of Arts at Columbia University. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian.
Professor Blint. Ren Weschler, there have been many conferences and celebrations and remembrances of James Baldwin, and I think you have a nod to that in the title of this particular year-long series. You call it James Baldwin This Time. Mm-hmm. So we'll bite. Why James Baldwin at this time?
I really do feel, and several of us who got this going were having a conversation about this, that Baldwin is arguably, of that generation of writers, the most salient, the most pertinent, notwithstanding one of the most gorgeous writers, but mm-hmm. also the things he was writing about are so pertinent to the situation right now of all times, when we are supposedly at a post-racial moment. We have a president who's black, so we don't need to think about this anymore. But whereas on the contrary, at a time when voter registration is under attack, when we have 10 times more prisoners in prison today than when Baldwin was writing about this problem. I mean, the things that Baldwin was getting at are so important. And so there's a whole group of us, and it began with Harlem Stage up in Harlem. That's going to be part of this in Columbia, and us. And we got together, and we just said we should have a whole year devoted. It strikes me that Baldwin is, if anything, a little bit occluded in the conversation. He should be absolutely one of the first people talk about.
So, Jamaica Kincaid, you're participating in the opening keynote conversation on April 23rd, I see, along with the choreographer Bill T. Jones and the artist Carrie Mae Weems. How do you see your connection as a writer or as an American to James Baldwin?
Oh, my goodness. I was just reading an essay of his about being an artist. It's called The Artist's Struggle for Integrity. And I kept, as I read it, I kept thinking, when was this written? It's there's something so eternal about it, so fresh, so extraordinary, pertinent and personal, as if it was written only for me, or, well, not only for me, but I think everyone who does something called art will read it and think, oh, this is just this conversation that this writer directed solely for me. He's so, as Ren said, so salient. It's impossible to not think of him every day. At some point earlier, I was talking to Hilton Owls, and I said to him, I thought that every African-American household ought to just have a complete collection of James Baldwin's work just as a kind of penance, because there was something that he did that was extraordinary for an artist. He gave so much to this, his tribe, as he called it, and he was always seems to be shifting tribes. Sometimes the tribe was us African Americans, sometimes it was other artists, you know, but he just was so full of this extraordinary thing. I've never heard a writer use the word love in this way so often.
In what way?
Love for community, love for people. He even thought, he actually seemed to think that the problem with white Americans was that they didn't love themselves, that the problem with racism wasn't really hatred of us, but it was hatred of themselves, that love of themselves would prevent them from participating in the horrible things they participated in and perpetrated in our society.
Professor Blent, you're nodding.
I'm nodding because Baldwin says love is a growing up. And he also said, I don't want to be white, I want to grow up. He also said love has never been a popular movement, and no one's ever really wanted to be free. And so for him, it has always been the quality, the quantity of love that will overhaul, as I've been saying for some time now, our current crisis, you know, a kind of protracted crisis.
Yeah.
That word has fallen out of our public discourse. It's funny. I notice when I prepare this Martin Luther King celebration that we do every year, how much the word love shows up in his speeches in a political context.
Exactly.
And then recently I realized LBJ too, in the context of the Civil Rights Act.
Yes.
He talked about love. Can you imagine even President Obama standing up there and speaking in terms of love? I think he'd get laughed off the podium.
But this is not touchy-feely, Haight-Ashbury love. This is a very complicated thing. And just as one of the things that's fascinating about him that for me is so exciting is he uses this we, and it is we Americans he's talking about, and we Americans have a problem with love. And America is a huge problem, and it's a very, very complicated thing he's talking about, and love. And it has to do with authenticity and the flight from love, which is a huge thing he talks about, is really important. And I look at the House of Representatives, for example, and I think that all the time.
Flight from love.
Yeah.
Jamaica Kincaid, did you want to keep going on that?
Oh.
Sounded like you were trying to get in.
Well, I was agreeing. No, I'm struck by that. And Ren is right. It's not just feely love. Love turns out, to be this very difficult thing. Love turns out to be hard work, and love turns out to be, and by the hard work, I mean love is action, you know. And if you love someone and you see them drowning, you try the act of love is to save them, is to maybe even risk your own life. It's not just sort of to wave and send a card. That love was really something that you do, that you practice. It had a muscle tone to it. It had a real activity to it. And but I was constantly overwhelmed by that feeling, and especially in the essays. And it's in the essays for me, you know, that his artistry just comes alive, just and the freshness of it, the devotion. As I say, just sort of every household, certainly in the African community, because I sometimes feel that among the things that happened to him, one central thing is that he sacrificed the artist got somehow a lot less. The artist got less than the person writing the essays. But the essays themselves become superior art. They are just of an extraordinary level of thinking and of shape, of form, that is humbling to read.
Just to follow up on that and about the injunction to have every African-American, I would say every American household should have Baldwin's tenets. But for me, we have to understand love as a kind of moral proposition, right? And so the flight that Ren just spoke about is the flight from our kind of common disaster, a shared, really complex, contradictory history. And so when Baldwin evokes love, it's not romantic love or things like that, although he talks about that as well. It's much more about a kind of historical confrontation, historical encounter.
And so here's another clip of Baldwin, and this was just after a famous meeting that he had with then U.S. Attorney General Robert Kennedy.
I think that one has got to find some way of putting the present administration of this country on the spot. One has got to force somehow from Washington a moral commitment, not to the Negro people, but to the life of this country. It doesn't matter any longer, and I'm speaking for myself, for Jimmy Baldwin, and I think I'm speaking for a great many other Negroes too. It doesn't matter any longer what you do to me. You can put me in jail, you can kill me, but by the time I was 17, you were done everything that you could do to me. The problem now is, how are you going to save yourselves?
James Baldwin, 1963. And Professor Blant, you smiled, you put your hand to your heart when you realized what clip that was going to be. Why?
That conversation I explored for some time, and he was so candid there. He was very disappointed after that meeting with Bobby Kennedy. He was with Lorraine Hansberry and some others. And in an interview with Kenneth Clark, he is, like he says, you can't do anything else to me, you know? And he's asking for a certain moral commitment in 1963 at a time when our country was in crisis and in some ways still remains in crisis. So that clip always does it for me, Brian. It's just really pointed and direct. And again, his moral imagination is so clear.
Was that the conversation, by the way, where Bobby Kennedy said that you might be able to be president in 40 years?
Absolutely.
Tell that story. That's amazing.
I mean, he said Bobby Kennedy recently made me the soul-stirring promise that 30 years, if I'm lucky, I can be president too. And he goes on to say, never into this boy's mind, never into this country's mind, but that perhaps I wouldn't want to be. And what he says is he's not concerned with any Negro first. That would really exercise his mind what kind of country that president would be president of. And I think that's the question, right? Baldwin's always concerned with content, not symbolism. Like, again, real transformation, you know?
Hence James Baldwin this time.
And so there's a Baldwin quote that you were just referring to about a hypothetical, quote, first Negro president. And I know that you both know this quote. So Baldwin wrote, quote, and in any case, what really exercises my mind is not this hypothetical day on which some other Negro first will become the first Negro president. What I am really curious about is just what kind of country he will be president of.
Exactly.
That seems prophetic.
Right?
Yeah.
So what do you think he'd be looking at today with President Obama? Do you ask yourself that question?
Well, one of the things we're going to have a whole session at the initial festival, and I again to reiterate the festival that's April 23rd to April 27th at New York Live Arts is just the launch of a whole year of events that'll take place at Columbia and at the Harlem Stage and so forth. But one of our events is going to be precisely what would he think of what's going on with voter registrations? What would he make of the Tea Party? We're asking all those questions, but actually you...
Yeah, the answer is obvious to those questions.
Well, no. It is obvious, and yet it is deep. And when I say it's salient, what he would precisely make of it is actually... He wouldn't just condemn it or something. He would talk about America and about a deep, deep, soulful, deep problem in America that is something that people should be talking about. And I think, frankly, that's one of the paucity, the thinness of political discourse in this country is part of why you need Baldwin right now.
Absolutely. Jamaica.
Oh, I was going to say the political discourse or the artistic discourse. I mean, it's still sort of astonishing, and I hope this doesn't sound too self-serving, but it's just... I think that there were perhaps more people of color prominently publishing, for instance, or artists than there are now. I mean, one of the astonishing things, you look at any of the publications that deal with the arts, and it's just sort of strangely peach-colored or... doesn't look an awful lot like him there, or that kind of artistic voice, that kind of energy seems not to be encouraged. You know, you have people having a lot, so much of what a writer's life is living in, you know, Brooklyn or some stupid place like that. But there doesn't seem to be that sort of vitality. But maybe it's true in all the arts, but I can't find a voice like that. I can't find an engagement like that with society. I can't find it in the world, I don't know what to call it, the white robe. But the thing that you see in his work, in his novels, in the essays, but in the art, I'm sorry.
That's okay. And as we talk about James Baldwin in what would have been his 90th birthday year, Jamaica, if you want to finish that thought, or we'll go to a caller.
Oh, I just was going to say, you know, taking on that with risk, that vitality, risking your reputation, risking your place in the social order, just saying something that, you know, that upsets things, that speaks to something true. I think an amazing aspect of him was this compulsion almost and this devotion to something he called the truth. Not that he knew what the truth was, but he was going to pursue it. And I'm so inspired and amazed at that how miss so much that kind of passion and that kind of devotion to the truth.
Let's take a caller. Kyla in Harlem, you're on WNYC. Good morning, Kyla.
Good morning, Brian. I'm so happy. It's been a number of years since I've called in, and this is my favorite topic. I went to Vassar, and I was an American culture major, whatever that means. And I really, my education was centered around the work of James Baldwin. I studied under the late scholar Stephen Moore, who was really a master of his work. And, you know, I'm mixed race. My family is Jamaican and Jews, Holocaust survivors. And I grew up in New York City, and so I was always sort of looking around at racism and trying to understand this American experience. And when I opened The Fire Next Time, and the copy I had was my dad's from when he went to City College as a recent immigrant, and it suddenly opened the door to understand what the experience of being American meant and what it was. And through his work, through his fiction, and through mostly his nonfiction, I could really step across that boundary and claim my own Americanness. It was very healing for me to understand that America wasn't this thing I'd learned about in history books with white people over here and black people over here, but rather there was this common soul and this common experience of trauma and pain and liberation and resistance, and that had to come together in each one of us, as well as in the society at large. And so it's beautiful to listen to Ms. Kincaid and others talk about his legacy today, because it really is that complex, that devotion of self, the understanding who you are that might save our nation. And I think that's what Baldwin was really speaking to, and it helped me as a young woman immeasurably.
Lawrence Wechsler?
Yeah, I just want to say two quick points. One of them that's fascinating about Baldwin is he has to leave America. He has to save his own life. In 1948, he flees America. He's convinced if he didn't, he would either be a drug addict or a prisoner or dead. And he goes to Paris.
This is the late 1940s.
Late 1940s. And it's actually in Paris, and partly under the thrall of Henry James, actually, in Paris, that he discovers that what he is isn't a black person or a gay person, but an American. And from that point forward, all of his writing is about that. One of the things that's fascinating there, by the way, is that his writing about, for example, in Giovanni's Room, where he writes all the characters are white, by the way, but he writes about a deeply closeted, dishonest man who can't come to terms with his own sexuality, that he actually is gay and is living this totally false life. And that's interesting in itself. But what's really interesting is that that becomes a figure for what America is doing all the way through. One other thing, just very quickly, by the way, she mentioned Fire Next Time. One of the things I urge people to come by, even if you're not going to attend any of the events at New York Live Arts on 19th Street, come by, because we have this Hank Willis Thomas five-screen thing that you've been playing pieces of. But also upstairs, we have taken The Fire Next Time, how it first appeared in The New Yorker in November 1962, and we've made a mural out of its appearance. And to see it running one column of text with five columns of advertising, all of it luxury ads, all of it madman. Huh. It's just so strange. There's not a single black face in any of the ads. On the very last page where he rises to that crescendo about if we don't deal with this, it's going to be no more water the fire next time. On one of that, it's an ad for jewelry, and the text is, "Chains abound."
Wow.
It's an amazing thing to look at.
Where can people see that again?
That'll be on 19th Street at 219 West 19th, which is the New York Live Arts, which is where the whole festival will be taking place between April 23rd and April 27th. But if you just go by, you can just go take a look at it. And it's really something to look at.
So,
a wall of the New Yorker and a wall of Dan. It's basically Don Draper's wet dream. Yeah.
And inadvertent contrast.
Right, it's amazing.
And let's play one more audio clip of James Baldwin, who was a great public speaker. And he debated William F. Buckley in 1965. The premise was the American dream is at the expense of the American Negro, quote. And we have a video of the whole debate up on our site at WNYC.org. It's long, nearly an hour, but worth watching for many of you. And it's certainly worth playing a clip right now. So the audience at the Cambridge Union Society was pretty much entirely white. And as you can see in the video, they are totally captivated by Baldwin's remarks, 33 seconds of which we hear now.
And in the moment you are born, since you don't know any better, every stick and stone and every face is white. And since you have not yet seen a mirror, you suppose that you are too. It comes as a great shock around the age of 5 or 6 or 7 to discover the flag to which you have pledged allegiance along with everybody else, has not pledged allegiance to you. It comes as a great shock to discover that Gary Cooper killing off the Indians when you were rooting for Gary Cooper, that the Indians were you.
The Indians were you. Mm-hmm. And I guess the punchline is that in that debate before a white audience, on the premise the American dream is at the expense of the American Negro, true or false, Baldwin won that debate 540 to 160 in a vote of the audience.
Yes, he did. I mean, that's really incredible. I've listened to that and watched that so many times. But it's a profound indictment of American society. And when he says that the American dream is at the expense of the American Negro, he also says in the beginning of Notes of a Native Son, published in 1955, that the history of America is the history of the Negro in America, right? So that inextricable kind of bounding up is what he was always concerned with. To go back to the caller before, who came to terms with what it means to be on this soil through Baldwin, right? This kind of code citizen, this common disaster ethos. That was I guess that was his gospel. He said he left the church to preach the gospel, and that was the moral terrain on which he operated.
But it wasn't a black problem. It was a white problem. Or it was an American problem. In other words, he doesn't even believe that there are blacks as such. I mean,
right? He doesn't. I mean, he says, as long as you think you're white, there's no hope for you. So what he's getting at there is not just the invention of race in America as a modern advent, but just the mythology around it, the associations that sediment and accrue around this thing that's only, at that time, 100 and a half years old or 200 years old.
We're over time, but let me take one more caller, because Murphy in Manhattan says he teaches Baldwin in a lit class. Murphy, just give us the context. Who do you teach? How do you use Baldwin?
It's in Bed-Stuy.
Uh-huh. What grade?
It's the old boys' high. I shouldn't say anymore. I might get in trouble. But it's a beautiful old building, no prison.
School's off today. You're allowed to be calling in.
Say it again?
School's out today for break. You're allowed to be calling in.
Yes, that's why I'm listening. I can't listen. I would be teaching right now. I would be teaching some boring Regents class.
And you teach James Baldwin and Jamaica Kincaid?
Yes, both. If Beale Street Could Talk and Annie John are central texts for my class.
And how? Give me a flavor. Give me something.
Well, you know what's really sad? They don't want to read. They have to, like, force feed the reading. It's very sad.
Welcome to high school.
But once they get into it. Beale Street is more, you know, when you say it's a girl who's pregnant and the guy's in jail with a racist cop, they kind of get into it. Annie John's a tougher sell, but once they start reading it, they love it.
By the way, one of the things that's going to happen, all 5 days of the festival, April 23rd through 27th at New York Live Arts, at noon, we're going to have all kinds of amazing people reading for free the works of James Baldwin.
Like who?
Oh, God. We're going to have V.J. Iyer, the musician. Robert Krolwich, of all people, is going to be Kathleen Chalfant.
Our own from Radio Lab.
Right. Kathleen Chalfant.
Issa Davis, Toshi Regan, Che Gossett. Incredible people. We're reading from noon to 1:30 every day at New York Live Arts.
Let's wrap it up this way. You have each said that Americans, I think somebody said Black Americans and somebody else said Americans, should have the collected work of James Baldwin in their home. Assuming that that's a high bar, what's the first thing that people who never read Baldwin should read? You want to leave us with that, each of you, on your way out the door, Professor Rich Blint from Columbia University?
I would go with the collection Notes of a Native Son.
I think I would go with that too. But in particular, I think I would read the Notes of a Native Son. Yeah.
I would go with Fire Next Time, for example, would be a very good place to start. But also in this in the short story collection, Going to Meet the Man. That story and Sonny's Blues, I mean, those are both relatively short stories. And they, if that doesn't get you, nothing will.
Jamaica what?
Eve Beals, yes. I mean, I wouldn't know where to begin. Every time I think, oh, this is it, I read something else. And, I mean, what's amazing is the extraordinary capacity for saying something new about this seemingly intractable heart of the white person, whatever that is, the white person. Why would anyone want to be a white person?
Well, maybe there are white people who are like, okay, I'm me, that's it, it's okay. I just have to, you know, understand what it actually means in historical and present context.
Well, that's the price of the ticket, isn't it, right? What it actually
that
means.
That is the price of the ticket. Which is another, yes, that's the final.
Hopefully it's the price of the ticket of any privilege, if that's what we're really talking about, to
the
look
price
at your
of the
privilege.
The ticket is freedom.
That's it right there, Jamaica.
And so we leave it there with Jamaica Kincaid, Rich Blint, Lawrence Weschler, and you can find the links on our site to this whole shebang of James Baldwin events at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show, also some of the videos and other things that we've been talking about and excerpting from. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, the new shadows in Central Park this spring. Thank the new high-rises. And we will also talk about that new traffic jam purposely caused by government officials in New Jersey. You know, the little Pulaski Skyway thing? Stay with us.